All right, very good. The next matter on our calendar is the case of Hildebrandt versus Hildebrandt. The file number is A-19-1609. And counsel, you will each have 15 minutes for your oral argument. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral argument. And the appellant may proceed at this time.
Your Honors, Robert Manson appearing on behalf of appellant Randy Hildebrandt. The issue in this case is fairly straightforward and pretty simple. Client is claiming that there was a dissipation of assets into the marital homestead through the failure of the respondent wife to make payments on the mortgage. And in fact, there's documentation that she gambled away substantial amounts of money. The bank statements were entered into evidence, and they reflect a number of years of great amounts being spent. In 2017, 38,000.
One quick question before we get further into your argument, Mr.
I'm having trouble hearing you, Your Honor.
This is Judge Flory. Do you acknowledge that it was the appellant or your client's burden? Oh, am I? Can you hear me? Do you acknowledge that it was your client's burden to prove dissipation before the trial court?
Yes, Your Honor, we believe we met that burden very clearly. Court's primary finding, or what it appears to be, is the claim.
All right,
that,
thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. The court's primary finding against that seems to be the respondent wife's testimony that they always gambled together. She only went a couple of times without him. The problem with that and the finding, and the reason the findings the court is really against logic and against the facts and the record, is again, my client was without income from December 11th, 2016 through February 22nd, 2018. He had no income, no ability to gamble. If in fact that respondent wife's allegations were true that they gambled together, you certainly would expect the gambling to have decreased during that time frame. But when you look at the previous years and compare it, the amounts did not decrease. It's very clear that her statement just was not supported by the record. In fact, was directly contradictory. Additionally, the W-2G is issued by the casino. If these people have been gambling equally, as the respondent wife would claim, you'd expect W-2Gs to be issued in my client's name as well. And they weren't issued at any point in time in my client's name. So what you
Mr.
have-
Mr. Manson, can I, go ahead, Judge Hooten.
Oh, yeah, I was just gonna ask though, I mean, what about the finding that there is evidence that this couple had been gambling since at least 2011, and that this appeared to be something that they did as a couple, or at least it was part of their lifestyle to have gambling.
Two things. One is that's just against the logic and the evidence that was presented to the court. If the two of them were gambling equally, what you would have again is a drastic decline in the amount of funds being gambled once my client's income decreased and once the parties separated. And that just didn't happen. Those amounts pretty well stayed consistent even after my client's income was out of the picture and he was out of the picture, Your Honor. Plus, what we have is, regardless of that finding during the marriage, what we do have is that during that 1 year, during the time frame that this matter was pending, the mortgage was not paid for that entire year, and yet $38,000 was gambled by respondent wife. And again, this was during a time period that my client could not have gambled because he had zero income. And there's no dispute that he had no income coming in during that time period. To be able to gamble, and certainly during that time period, had no ability to pay that mortgage. What happened during that year is, without the mortgage being paid, the loan modification was signed in December 2017, which again was signed prior to my client's resumption of income. And that increased the mortgage balance to $230,700. It had been, I think, about $158,000 at the time of valuation earlier that year in 2017. So
aren't you asking us basically to to reverse a judge's determination of credibility here? Because didn't the judge find that the respondent credibly testified that they both gambled and this was part of their lifestyle, at least since 2011? How can we do that as a reviewing court?
Because credibility determinations don't insulate a judge from making findings that are in accord with the facts presented to it, or from speculating as to whether or not my client may have gambled. What you have is very clearly that the credibility determination, again, doesn't obviate the facts that were presented to the court. And the facts presented to the court was during the pendency of this divorce. During 2017, there was no way that these parties gambled together. My client had no income, no ability to pay that mortgage during that 1 year. Respondent wife did gamble $38,000 and spent that in casinos and withdrawals and the rest, and that was not denied at the time of trial. But what you have is that the facts are that during that year, when the mortgage was clearly not being paid and ended up in that loan mod with increase in equity and loss of equity, increase of balance and loss of equity, that the statement that they gambled together is impossible. What you have is it's clearly against logic, it's against the facts that are presented to the court, and just making a determination that somehow one party saying, oh, we gambled together, when none of the evidence supports that claim and is directly contradictory, court as the case law I presented.
Go ahead.
Mr. Hansen, can I approach it from a slightly different angle? I assume the parties do not dispute that whether he did as many times as her, she has gambled since I think 2011 is the date we referred to. And the last element of the statute for dissipation requires that your client prove the transfer was not in the usual course of business. If there's a dispute genuinely, the judge didn't think so about them gambling together, how would you overcome that element if she's doing what she's done throughout their entire marriage?
Because that's really not, my client also testified that it caused problems throughout the marriage. He frequently told her not to gamble. You had a lot of overdrafts and things that were going on. Just because somebody did it, A, doesn't necessarily mean it's with consent. B, certainly doesn't mean it's not frivolous spending of money. And during the divorce, that kind of changes the complexion as well, because she had a duty to maintain that mortgage when there was no income on my client's part. And again, Your Honor, so this is a situation where she made about $7,800 a month gross just from one source of income, plus her income from Alina. So this is somebody who's making almost $103,000 when my client had absolutely no income coming in. And even after that, when he was out of the household, it was awarded to her. The court says, well, you know, I don't want to pay the mortgage at that point. Her income, even when my client's income was coming back, was almost three times the income. So what you have is an equitable argument as well, that she had the much greater ability to make that $1,400 a month payment, Your Honors. He was in.
Well,
the
is there anything in the record that required her to make that as opposed to him? Or is there anything you can point to that assigned the responsibility for the payment of the mortgage?
There wasn't, but as I indicated, that's kind of why I'm looking at that 2017 timeframe. And we weren't going into maybe what was lost through foreclosure or what have you. What we have is that clearly by December 2017, before my client had any income and making any income, that modification lost the judge. Are you there, Judge Hooten?
Okay. I have to pause the clock, the marshal, if you would please. Thank you.
Thank you. Wasn't sure what to do. I haven't had a judge disappear on me during an appellate argument before.
Well, unfortunately.
Mr. Manson, I think you have six more minutes.
All right. Can you hear me, Judge Hooten?
Yes.
Very good. Then I will go ahead and recommence. I tried to stop as soon as you disappeared, so I will restart. Basically, whether or not you have that over and above anything that the court may order, statute provides the fiduciary duty under 518.58 that the parties owe a fiduciary duty to each other. The court is also to look at contributions to both appreciation of, as well as depreciation of an asset. And the case cited, the Carrick case that I cite, is very much in line where a woman took assets, cashed them out, went and gambled. And the court found that that certainly is not a necessity or in the ordinary course of business. And I believe she was ordered to, you know, recoup or to make that up, and found that to be dissipation. This case, while we don't have the hard assets being used, the money was being used by respondent wife rather than paying the mortgage. And that's where this becomes an issue, and it did indeed cause harm. If we had a situation where the mortgage was being paid, she was going to gamble some money, you may have a little more esoteric argument. But in this case, you have a very hard argument. It's very clear that there was a loss of equity in this property with the failure to pay the mortgage. And again, during the time period of my client, regardless of what the court found, it was an impossibility. They weren't gambling together. There was an order for protection. And again, the gambling, both in 2017 and 2018, continued pretty much unabated from the earlier years. So that's the concern here too. I don't think the court can say that someone testifies credibly when the facts are that stacked against that person. Again, it becomes against the logic and facts on the record, becomes that clearly erroneous standard that then kicks in and allows this court to reverse the trial court at that point in time. We also have the dollar amounts laid out, the $230,700 increase in the principal balance. That was found by the court. We have the base mortgage amount, that was about $158,000, that was laid out in the brief. And that's why we're asking that the court reverse, because the facts are there, and that there was an equity loss of $44,939. My client would have been entitled to half of that equity loss. And again, this is all stuff that occurred during the time frame that my client had no income, gambled unabated. And there was a clear dissipation, and there's no argument that respondent wife did not make these mortgage payments, making almost $100,000 a year. It's not even a case where you had to rely upon two incomes. Somebody leaves a house, they're making a total of 40, and somebody somehow has 20,000. This is a case where we have somebody making almost $100,000 with a $1,400 a month mortgage payment that isn't making it, and yet is spending $38,000 at the casinos. I mean, that's more, almost twice the mortgage payment every month. At that point in time, we clearly have a situation where there is that dissipation. It is clearly against logic and the facts on the record. And that one little piece of what the wife says they gambled together all the time is just outweighed to the point that it becomes absurd to make that finding in the face of the documentation, the evidence that was presented. Thank you.
Could I ask you one thing? And that is that the court makes note that your client did not supply his bank records, whereas the respondent did.
Well, actually,
and that was factored into the court's decision on this issue. How do you respond to that?
Oh, because again, the time period we're looking at for our argument is 2017. There's no dispute my client had no income. He had no bank records because he had no income. So this is a situation where, again, we're looking at a situation here where my client wasn't out over here making a bunch of money and now claiming, oh, she should have paid the mortgage. This is a situation where my client had zero income from, again, December 11, 2016 to February 22nd, 2018. And that's where we're arguing that these damages really primarily occurred was during that time frame. And that's why finding of the judge, it doesn't even matter if she found they gambled together during the marriage. It certainly didn't in 2017. There's nothing that indicates that. And again, the gambling continued unabated. If they gambled together and they're not together, you would expect that if they're gambling equally, that amount would cut in half or even less. Or again, if I can't make the mortgage, I make $100,000 a year. I certainly shouldn't be out gambling and spending that money at the casinos and not paying the mortgage. And that's why we have these statutes set up. And that
what are we to make of the court's findings, though, Mr. Manson, that your client, while he was suspended from his payments until February of 18, he did get reinstated and he got a year's worth of back payments at that point that he still did not apply either to the mortgage or to the support of the child.
I think at that point in time, the damage had actually been done. The equity was lost at that point in time. And in fact, the respondent wife still didn't pay the mortgage. So what we're talking is during that, and plus I think he ended up with about $15,000 that was then said to be his non-marital portion. But at that point in time, I mean, eventually child support was established. You know, he ends up paying the child support. But again, this is still a case where you have a situation where during that time period, the critical time period, we have somebody making $100,000 a year, not paying that mortgage and gambling the money away. So it's an equitable argument as well. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. The respondent may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. James D. Capra. I am the attorney for the respondent. With regard to this case, I think the trial court correctly determined this is not a dissipation case. Now, to the extent that Minnesota Statutes 518.58 is to fashion a fiduciary duty in this case, I expect it would be to discourage doing a spend down of funds to prevent the other party from getting into the property split, or just an expression of spite or bad financial judgment. But this case does not fit. The trial court, as indicated, the parties have a history of gambling. I produced tax records back to 2014. Counsel said it himself. Between 2014 and 2016, the parties out of the joint TCF checking account spent $142,000. I think what that proves, because you cannot, and the court said, can't tell who spent that money or not just by looking at joint statements, that the marital gambling is just more of the same. It's hardwired into their marital lifestyle, prudent or not. Now, is there a fiduciary duty not to gamble, particularly during the marriage? Well, there had been significant gambling for years, but the court chose not to do a judicial marital audit of how the parties spend their money. The problem with the appellant's case, in addition to it being pretty much the normal course of business here, is 518.58 subdivision 1 specifies without the consent of the other spouse. They say it once in each of the two circumstances. So clearly the lack of consent issue is to be the one of the focuses of that inquiry. Now, evidence was needed by the appellant to show, I don't approve of this, which is a tough argument to make under circumstances like this. If you look at the record, there's no even attempt to say, I forbid you to gamble anymore. We're going through a divorce. In the history of the gambling, you sure have a hard time inferring it, a lack of consent.
So, Mr. Capra, what are we to make of appellant's argument that from January of 17 through the trial, your client had significant income and exclusive occupancy of the home, yet made no payments or apparent attempts to pay the mortgage in the matter? What are we to make of that? That does seem as though there's a basis for her ability to pay and the opportunity to occupy the premise and with no effort to maintain it. Where does that argument factor in here?
Well, she did have a gambling problem, I think, and people don't often act rationally in that regard, but she also had other bills that he did not contribute to. There was a substantial amount of time where she occupied the house, but however, there was no, at no point in this did the appellant make a motion to assign responsibility for the mortgage during the marriage. or during the pendency of this action. It's a joint asset. They both have a responsibility to it. Whether the appellant had the ability to contribute to that investment or not, I submit had not been shown. So I think she is guilty of not protecting the asset, but I think it was kind of a joint endeavor. I think bringing this asset into foreclosure was a joint venture, is what I would say. But if I may, I think the testimony was unanimous regarding the gambling. Both the parties attended casinos, and they both admitted it. They both spent money gambling, and they admitted that. The difference is a difference on to the degree of how much, the degree of how much each gambled. The appellant indicated not much, whatever that is determined to mean, and the respondent indicated they went there together and spent all that money as co-conspirators, if you will. And the court was within its discretion to say that the respondent's testimony was credible as to the degree, and they simply did all this together.
Mr. Capra, could I follow ahead. Up Judge Flory's question? And I'm referencing the summons statute in the 518.091 that all parties, when served with a dissolution, and the subdivision in particular, number one, says, and it's on the summons form, as I understand it, so all parties receive it, neither party may dispose of any asset except, and then the one that would be applicable for the necessities of life or for the necessary generation of income. That alone not be a basis together with the evidence that's been received. Let's assume for argument here, which I think the facts would support, that at least during their separation, the pending matter, she did gamble alone. Would that language not alone suggest the facts there that she violated that restraining order that applies in all dissolutions?
If you were to presume that she did gamble alone, perhaps, however, that statutory restraining order applies to both parties. And we suggest that there wasn't a proof that she was the only, they gambled separately, perhaps, or perhaps they didn't. The evidence wasn't there. So what I'm suggesting is a lot more with regard to the gambling issue. There, someone with the burden of proof needs to show that they did not gamble. Now, we didn't get the information that the appellant urges with regard to the lack of ability to gamble, and we didn't see any gambling records. So what I would suggest is, if to the extent that the respondent didn't make those payments, the appellant didn't either, and there wasn't a proof that he was less able to make those payments than she was, other than she had a good job during the marriage, but prior to that time he did as well. I think what I'm getting at here is that with regard to allocation of the responsibility for what happened, predominantly I would suggest it's the gambling, but who's more responsible? Counsel seeks to replace evidence with inference. We have the TCF joint checking statements withdrawal combined with the testimony, I don't gamble much. The W-2 forms only show respondents' W-2s. It's only in her name. After the separation of parties, the sole substance of the evidence when looking at what happened during the marriage is respondents' U.S. bank records. The appellant did not produce any bank statements with regard to any income or assets he would have on deposits, but they're suggesting that he didn't have assets, he couldn't gamble because he didn't have anything to gamble with. As I said, the TCF count is joint. You cannot tell from looking at that. With regard to the W-2s, I think the respondent or the appellant explained it himself. You get those W-2s if you win a certain amount in specific shot, I think it's 25, 1250, but he said it never worked out. maybe he just wasn't as good at it. You couldn't really tell, but there's no basis to compare the gambling that went on, the spend down of the marital estate, because the respondent set up a separate account and disclosed her expenditures. Appellant admits to have a separate account and not a single statement. So we cannot compare when respondent complied and the appellant didn't. And the court simply thought it was unfair, in light of a duty to disclose before the court, to give appellant an advantage for non-disclosure.
Can I ask you this, though? I mean, as I heard the appellant argue this morning, he was saying he didn't have an income, he didn't have any bank transactions or bank account. If that's true, why should that be held against him if he didn't disclose those expenditures or bank records?
Well, he's asking for inference. That was not proved that he didn't have an income or he didn't have the resources. Now, if that was true, why wouldn't you show the minute you have a bank account statement, can't we see deposits? Can't we see what's going into your account and what's not? As far as his not having an income or assets, that's hard to say. He testified on direct exam that he liquidated a $50,000 pension account. Where's the money from that? Why isn't that on deposit? Why couldn't that have been split between the parties? Why couldn't whatever that money was, wherever it is, and it was not accounted for, why?
Was there evidence in the record that he had a bank account?
Yes. I think the appellant, counsel will admit that's where the lump sum distribution from the disability payment went. But there was $50,000 unaccounted for, and then there was the lump sum $14,500 received during the pendency after the attorney's cut. Where is that money? He offered in his discovery allegations that he received money from Arizona property, totaling hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was never accounted for during the proceeding. And what about the monthly disability benefits as previously brought up? Yes, it was discontinued for a time, but then it started up again. Where did that money go? He could have squirreled quite a lot of it away, given that he lived with his family. He didn't contribute to the household expenses. He didn't contribute to the mortgage or the utilities. He didn't contribute to the support of the child. So one would assume if we're going to hold him to his word, that there's a whole lot of money out there to help bail out the house, but he did not account for it. We don't have the bank statements. We don't have any explanation where all this money he testified to is. Now, without bank records, whether he had an income, whether he had resources, was just left to guesswork. There was nothing for the trial court to look at. Now, I submit it was for the trial court to consider the testimony, gauge credibility, review the exhibits. Now, I cited a case in my brief, Ballenbach versus Bollenbach, that stands for the proposition that both parties have of the duty to make full and accurate disclosure to facilitate the property, the court's property disposition. All the court had when deciding who is the more guilty party here, who deserves to take the hit for the loss of the homestead, who deserves to take the hit for all the historical gambling here, was the TCF joint statement, joint tax returns, neither of which can assign responsibility here, and the respondent's financial document, her income documents and her bank documents during the pendency of the divorce. There is nothing here from the appellant, and it really doesn't seem fair to apportion blame if you're not going to be making, you know, the kind of disclosures you would expect during a marital dissolution case. I think that failure disclosure in itself and failure to prove that this gambling wasn't, as it always was, completely by consent, it leads to a total inability to quantify between the parties the amount of any kind of dissipation injury. It wasn't proven. There was very clear evidence that should have been provided. It was requested in discovery, as indicated by the written discovery attached, but not provided. The court wasn't given the opportunity with evidence about how to allocate the blame. Failure disclosure should not give you that advantage.
All right. Well, thank you. And the appellate will now have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Basically, what that does puts us into a position of trying to disprove a negative. We didn't gamble. In this case, the claims about him somehow cashing out a 401k, there's no documentation as to that was presented, that was done during this time frame. I believe there's some indication that it was done to cover some gambling early on. But basically what you have too is that the client, you have to figure, is also suffering from a traumatic brain injury and is disabled, unable to nap, unable to focus. The concept that he could forbid respondent wife from gambling assumes an equal footing on a cognitive basis, and that just wasn't there at the time. But as it is, he testified. He'd tell her not to gamble that much. She'd go to work instead of, or go gambling instead of going to work, and he'd tell her you can't be doing that. So it's pretty clear that that was a concern to him all along. His testimony was he'd occasionally go or go, like I say, very limited basis. And the facts prove that out. Again, when you look at it, if they were gambling together, when they separated, you would expect those numbers to drop off, and they just didn't drop off. She gambled. There's no claims or no documentation that my client did anything inappropriate. What we do know from the record, from what the court found, was just that her claim was that they'd gambled together or gambled during the marriage. But again, during that 1 year period, there's obviously they weren't gambling together. It's obvious that he had no income, and there was no finding that he had any resources or income or anything during that time period. So what we have is that there is clear dissipation of assets. As Mr. Capra says, if you want to look at the blame for why the house went into foreclosure, the evidence is all there. The evidence is there that she continued to gamble. The gambling continued unabated. Again, we're talking significant amounts of money, $38,000 in 2017 and through August of 2018 and another $28,000. You do have the fiduciary duty to preserve the asset. He clearly had that ability. And rather than do that, he spent tens of thousands of dollars gambling. Again, we wouldn't be here if this was a situation where, oh, she just had some other expenses, she'd spent money on the necessities of life, and that's fine. We're here because she clearly and undisputedly gambled away tens of thousands of dollars while this house went into foreclosure. That is the epitome of a dissipation of an asset. Garrett case found it was, it's obviously frivolous spending, and there's nothing to point to appellant husband that he had ever done anything inappropriately, that he had frivolously spent, or that somehow he had dissipated anything. It's clear where the blame, or as Mr. Capra says, where the guilt lays, and it's with respondent wife. So we would ask the court to grant us our request of relief. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, very good. Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement.
Thank you.
Thank you for your oral arguments this morning.